Welcome to episode 6, everybody. It's been a while since we had one. I think 9 days since our last recording. The holidays kind of got in the way a little bit there. I'm gonna blame that.
Yeah, you got kids, man. Of course,
I got kids. I got kids and a dog. So yeah, we got a little cold here in Indiana too. Not that that matters, but
yeah.
So we're back. We're back. And we're going to start episode 6. We're going to have today a special guest, Jake, and he is in the National Guard.
Yeah, he is. It's Sergeant Jake Cash. He's in the Indiana National Guard, and he's actually the non-commissioned officer in charge of the Lebanon, Indiana Armory. So he's full-time guard, but before that, he was, I think, 8 years regular Army, and during that time, he was in the 3rd Infantry, and they're the ones that do the Army honors funerals at Arlington National Cemetery. He was at Fort Myer. And when he got out of the regular Army, he immediately went into the National Guard, and he's been there ever since. And he's only about a year or so away from retirement, I think. He's been in a long time. Besides, I know him real well because he also happens to be my son.
Yeah. Well, we're excited to have him here to further our discussion on militias. We also were planning on talking about socialism and finishing our continuing our discussion on socialism. I can't say finishing because I think we're going to be talking about it more as time goes on. But, again, there's been more current events happening that get in our way of our plans. But I want to touch on the stimulus bill that was recently passed begrudgingly by Trump, as well as the omnibus, two separate things. Seems to be a lot of confusion on this, and people, there's misinformation out there, a lot of misinformation about this. And it's just everywhere you look. All social media, just totally dumbfounded by these two things. Every year, the federal government has to do a bill, to have a spending bill for the year. It's basically a fiscal spending bill, right? Yes. It's the omnibus. And so that happens every year. So this is not totally out of the ordinary. What is out of the ordinary is the amount is much higher than normal. Yeah. And some of the stuff in it is a little wacky. But I think the main, the COVID relief bill is $900 billion, which is separate from the omnibus. And they're, inside of that is, you know, all of the spending for COVID relief, for payments, direct payments to individuals, $600 payments that you've all heard of, potentially $2,000 coming up here if that changes. I don't know. But and then there's all this stuff for schools and farms and small businesses. And so it's none of it is there's no foreign money going. There's no foreign aid in the COVID relief bill.
Yeah, this is all domestic stuff.
All domestic, yeah. All really geared towards the COVID relief stuff. And unemployment, too, is a big one, too. They increased the unemployment. So, and that was a heavily debated bill between the Republicans and Democrats. So they came to that conclusion. But unfortunately, at the same time, they had to try to pass the omnibus bill, which is like everything the government spends in 2021. And they gave them 24 hours or 48 hours to review it, and then it just had to be passed. So there's a lot of stuff in there, and I think that's what people are talking about more than the COVID relief bill doesn't seem too egregious. I mean, this is still a lot of money, but it's the other one, the omnibus, because you've got, you know, what is it, almost $700 billion for defense. You've got, mm-hmm. and inside that, I noticed a $2.3 billion submarine. Is approved $2 billion for our new super duper space force, you know, with those new uniforms or whatever they are. So it's, but the foreign aid that everybody keeps talking about, right? All these different politicians are raising these concerns that, COVID, why is foreign aid wrapped up in COVID relief? First of all, it's not at all. It's in the omnibus. Second of all, the amount of the foreign aid is somewhere between 12 and 15 billion, which is you know, it's a significant amount of money, but in relation to $1.4 trillion, it's really not. It's less than 1% of that.
Yeah, by today's government spending standards, that's chump change.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. But like, I also wonder, you know, where's this money coming from again? I mean, it's just they just print it, or you know, just.
You know, I think, you know, when in doubt, my feelings have always been, when in doubt, print more money, you know.
I wish I could do that.
Yeah, gosh, wouldn't that be great, you know. Instead of doing a podcast, we could be sitting on a 100-foot yacht somewhere in Tahiti and drinking martinis and pouting.
I think people have tried that before, but yeah, we failed most of the time. It does seem like we're headed for a bad place if we just continue to print money, devaluing our currency to a point of, you know, at what point is it going to break? You know, at what point are we going to just print so much money that our currency doesn't mean anything anymore? You know, because how can you just to continue to print money with it's not based on anything. It's based on trust. It's based on, basically it's based on trust and around the world and like that, this is valuable in this amount. And at what point does it start falling, and will it be a quick fall? Will it be like a crash? Will it be or will it be a slow decline? Because we continued, like we did $2.2 trillion in COVID relief in April, $2.2 trillion. Now we're doing another $2.3 trillion.
Yeah,
900 plus 1.4. So the federal government is. They have expensive tastes or something. It's just like, holy crap, you know?
Yeah, what was it?
$4.7 trillion in 1 year?
$500 toilet seat on Air Force One or something a few years ago. I mean, it's amazing. You know, I spent 10 years around the military. I contracted with them as a dentist, as a civilian, and... You know, I love the military. I've got a lot of respect for them, especially the ones that spend their lives in it, because this is not a way to get rich, folks, believe me. But anyway, it's just, and I don't know if it's because of the bureaucracy, but just from what I saw an awful lot of waste. And I was thinking, when I went into private practice, if I ran my private practice the way the government even ran its dental corps, I'd be bankrupt before noon. You know, it's just amazing. And I don't know if it's the culture or if it's the bureaucracy, but I know my older brother was in the Navy in the early 1960s, and he was stationed on an aircraft carrier. He's a Russian interpreter. He was in, you know, naval intelligence, all that good stuff. But anyway, he said when the year end came, they would. Oh, I stepped on the dog. She loves me, man.
She didn't yip or anything.
Yeah, she didn't yip. She didn't make any noise. I thought it was moving under my feet. But anyway, he said they would take equipment that was still in crates and whatever and throw it overboard. So they would include that in the budget for replacement, and it just made him sick. But again, I don't blame the military. I blame the system.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay. Well, you got to show a need for this. Okay, we'll just throw all this stuff overboard. Yeah, we need this. You know, and that's just the Navy and just what I saw. I mean, just the military in general. And again, I love the military. I've got nothing but respect for those folks. But I think it's indicative. What the part that bothers me most about it, it's not just the military. I think it's indicative of the federal government as a whole. The military is really a branch of the federal government. I mean, the president's the commander in chief. So ultimately, the military, very wisely, is under civilian control. But it's also a big part of the government. So I'm thinking, if I see this in the military, something tells me it's not just the military. Something tells me it's the federal government as a whole that's doing this. I mean, folks, if you ran your household, and I'm saying, I'll say if you ran your household like the government runs its business every day, you'd be so bankrupt you'd never get out of it.
Yeah. You might have heard me type in there. Federal government collected revenues of $3.5 trillion in 2019.
2019 alone.
Revenues.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
16% of gross domestic product. So typically it's 17%. Federal revenue average is 17% of GDP.
Which means that the overall countrywide federal tax rate is somewhere around 17%.
So if you're looking at $3.5 trillion in revenue and you're still running a deficit on that, you're spending a lot of money. He could be close to $5 trillion now. I mean, all of us that, as you know, America, the country, our federal government could be as of once that omnibus bill is executed, maybe $5 trillion deficit, you know, which is, that gets to be, you know, how do we get out of that? I don't know. And then you start thinking about the dollar, you know, diminishing and our economy hurting, and, you know, revenues are going to continue to fall. And it's a bad thing to think about. So I'm going to change the subject a little bit.
Okay. Whew. I know. It's everything since the election. I don't know about you, John, but for me, everything has been so fast and furious. I really personally am having a hard time keeping up with it. It's like when we do the show, I'm thinking, well, I can't put everything in the show. So, you have to decide what stays in and what stays out.
If we have a week's worth of stuff, it's a lot of stuff. Exactly. Even this morning, I saw Hawley, the H-A-W-L-E-Y, that senator from Missouri, you know, saying he's going to join Tuberville and some other Republicans disavowing the Electoral College votes. Still. So on January 6th, they're going to vote that it's not going to work. And then Mo Brooks and Gohmert trying to give Pence the authority to choose his own electors for the Electoral College. But again, it's futile because it's going to go to the House. It has to go to the House, and the House has to vote on it, and they're Democrat. So it's going to fail anyway. So I guess it's some sort of political play for these people to show that they support Trump. And they feel that, Trump, after losing the election and getting out of office, there's some movement that they want to be a part of. Or their constituents are... they're so pro Trump that you have to vote. You have to do that. There's no choice. Or again, I also had mentioned last time we talked about a little bit, individual needs for like a senator or, you know, working on selfish motives. Why would I vote this or vote that? They may have their own personal, you know, they want to stay in office, even if they don't believe in it, you know, so.
Well, you know, the point you made about, you know, showing support for Trump, and I mean, I'm not a Republican, obviously. I am really an independent, but to what end? What's in it for them to so vehemently support Trump? What's in it for
staying
them?
Staying in office, probably.
He's going to be out. He's going to be out come January. Well, as far as we know, he's going to be out January 20th, one way or another. But are they thinking he's going to make a big comeback in 2024 and that they want to be allied with him when he does?
Maybe just the state that they're representing is so pro-Trump that they have to continue supporting him, or else they'll not keep their job. You know, I don't know. It's I think a lot of people are confused. I was really confused by the whole thing that just came out when Trump is just obviously he's a very confusing guy, and he doesn't know the facts a lot of times, and he says things that are wrong, whether he intentionally does or not. I mean, it's just a lot of it's just emotional stuff. He just blurts out and never understands things fully. Such as the bill, the COVID bill, and he's like, yeah, I would like to increase the payout to $2,000 per person, and I think the Republicans were like, what? Because they didn't want that, you know, a lot of the Republicans didn't want that, and so put them in an awkward spot, and Mitch McConnell had to say no, and that's caused a rift, I think, in the Republican Party. And again, it just sort of confuses me. Like, where do they stand? What do they want? Mitch McConnell is looked at as the bad guy for keeping $1,400 out of people's pockets.
Yeah.
He just took $1,400 out of their pockets. So he's looked at as the bad guy, not Trump. Trump's like, no, I tried to get you $2,000, but those Republican guys. So it's like almost like he's trying to get out on his own faction, like a separate, party or something. I don't know.
Maybe he's going to start his own party, the Trumpists, the Trumpites or whatever. But I know McConnell, as far there, well, and they're still hung up on the defense bill because, Trump vetoed it.
And because of, the Twitter stuff.
Yeah, because of the Twitter stuff and all that. But McConnell, this was McConnell, said that either the president, A, had not read the bill, or he read it and he didn't understand it.
Yeah.
And today, Trump, and today being December 30th, we're day before New Year's Eve, Trump said unless the Republican Party wants to commit suicide, they will pass the $2,000 check bill. So I'm like, and again, I'm like, so where it seems like the it's kind of like the Republicans are turning on each other.
That's my point was.
It's, yeah,
I'm exactly. Not really sure. It seems like there's like some sort of fallout happening.
And
I'm not sure where people are landing. They're landing and it's like a grenade went off and people are landing all over different places. And Trump is the grenade. But
well, the two Republican incumbent governors, or governors, boy, I'm doing real well today. I need another drink. Senators from Georgia, Loeffler, and I can't remember the other
Purdue.
One. Purdue, that's right.
Leffler. How could you forget Purdue? It's your favorite.
Hey, what? Dude, you talk about pouring salt in an open wound. I had two kids turn on me and go to that place. Anyway, that's for a different day. But, boy, all of a sudden.
Purdue is a school in Indiana, for those of you not in Indiana.
Which,
I think I've been looking at some of the stats of who's listening to this, and there are people all over the country and some in other countries too. So thanks for listening, everybody. I need to get a better way for you guys to contact us because nobody's contacting us through the John and Tom show at gmail.com because I don't think people use email anymore. I need to find a better way for you guys to
contact. It's like your generation doesn't talk on the phone anymore. I have to text everything.
I hate the phone. Yeah.
But what you need to do, folks, tell your friend, your family, your friends, your neighbors, everybody about the John and Tom show. We are the best show on...
Ever. Pretty much absolutely. Ever in the history of shows.
We are the best podcast out there. You need to hear us.
I just recently added a little secondary name to the John and Tom show. I called it the Search for Common Ground. So
that wasn't
a mistake. It's true. We are searching for common ground. I know it's hard for people to believe right now in this climate, but that's the purpose of this show. We do have our own opinions, our own views, but our goal is to listen to opposing views, people with opposing views, and we want everybody to listen to each other again. I don't know, did they ever? But more than they are now. Let's just say that there's a lot of closed minds, closed hearts out there, and a lot of really harsh talk. I'm on Twitter, and I'm guilty of responding my own way, probably negatively, but it's just. People post these things and they're just so incendiary and they're so obviously just, they seem just so wrong and they're so inflammatory. And I have a hard time not responding, but I shouldn't, I guess. But I wonder, do they really believe those things? Are they just trying to get clicks? Are they just trying to get notoriety? Like, like Matt Gaetz and Jim Jordan. Those guys are just, the things they say are just awful and not true most of the time. Most of the time, they're not true. And I have a hard time, and I'm not a extreme left-wing person. I'm a common sense, logical person. And I just, the things they're saying they incense people. They get people mad. They get them riled up. it doesn't help. And I'm so tired of that kind of stuff. And they're obviously, you know, they may be pissed off, but again, they may just be trying to like make money or keep their job or something. We still don't know that, but
yeah.
But I'm just tired of that kind of just, and there's just so many people doing it, you know, just, you know, I only respond to people on Twitter because I just like, I don't have any followers, too many followers, but I don't think I would just post things just to get people riled up. It just doesn't, I think you, I don't know. Anyway, back to my original point. We are trying to have this podcast. We want to bring people on like Jake, like we had Scott last week. I think that went pretty well. Episode 4, if you haven't listened to it, Scott is an anesthesiologist out of Kentucky. He's a pro-Trump. We talked about the election, about some COVID things and some other things. So I plan to do more with people with opposing views, and not just talk to us, but maybe even get two people with opposing views as well as us, you know, or something like
yeah,
that. I don't
exactly.
know. It doesn't always have to be us as the one side, you know, like, but we'll work on it. So another thing we're going to try to touch on, do you have anything else that I was going to move into like a little bit more about socialism, but
yeah. What I was going to say is I'm just kind of a follow up on what John said is we really want this podcast, you know, when you do these things like, well, okay, what do you really want to accomplish? What do you really want to do? And what John and I really want to do with this podcast is have it as an open forum. You know, we want to hear from people, whether they agree with us or don't agree with us. You know, I want to hear opposing views, because I think that's what it's, if we could get more people just to listen to each other, you know, we may have a better understanding of each other. We may be able to compromise a little bit more, as in democracy.
It's incredible to me that Matt Gaetz and Jim Jordan are so incredibly biased, and they're senators.
Oh,
I think
yeah.
They're senators.
Yeah.
They're senator or house, I forget. But and they represent, you know, a state. And it's like those guys are just inflaming everything. And lighting fires everywhere.
That
those guys should not be doing that. That's not helping. You know, like I don't even know if I'd want them on the show, because they're not. I don't think they're doing it. I don't trust their motives.
No, I don't either. I don't either. I well, you know, it's just like Alex Jones, for Christ's sake. I mean, he has his own radio show, and I mean, if you haven't listened to him, listen to him, because it's
some crazy stuff.
Yeah,
man.
It is really crazy stuff, and how he can get a medium to he you know, like I said, he has his own radio show and all that. That he's well known, and everything he puts out is garbage. You know, and I just don't understand.
I mean, he's an absolute sensationalist.
Oh,
I think, and he's
sure.
He's a conspiracy theorist. And he does it for money. I think he does it for his fame, and he loves his aggressive, you know, style, and people like it. People like that aggressive style, and for whatever reason, that they think it's entertaining. Conspiracy theories are fun to toss around, you know, but it's also incredibly dangerous if people take them seriously.
Believe
you know?
It. Yeah, you know? Exactly. That's the problem. Well, you know, of course, he loves to get out there. He puts on his aviator glasses and his fatigues and all that, and totes a gun and marches with the Proud Boys and all that stuff, because that's his core. That's the people.
Those are who's listening to
that's,
him.
That's his people. And all he's doing is promoting. You know, I don't think... He come right down to it. I don't think he
may or may
believes
not
the
it.
Crap.
He may or may
he
not believe
it.
It.
See, that's just it. I don't think he does.
That's the same thing with a lot of people. And then, I'm going to be a little biased here, but I think of Fox. Like I would say, like Bill O'Reilly or Hannity or Tucker Carlson. Like even the other day, Hannity said, "I don't vet the things that I say. I just say them." I mean, he's like. Do they, they're just, this is their job. They're making money and they can't, they can't go back. Once they've gone that direction, they can't go back and say, you know, because then they're going to lose their livelihood. So I think that does play a part. And I think that plays a part not only in the media, but it plays a part in politics, that politicians, individual politicians,
oh, yeah,
wanting to stay in power, to make money, to continue their, you know, maybe a lot of them do have, you know, some beliefs, some righteousness that they, you know, but it's, I don't know. You look at the path of a politician, how they get into power.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm kind of repeating myself. Some of the things I've said on previous shows, but you know, it is important. But back to what I was saying, we were going to continue our discussion on socialism. I think Tom has a few things to bring up.
Yeah, just to kind of let me get one. Yeah, here we go. Yeah, you know, socialism. We talked about socialism as actually an economic system, and it's people think it's a way of government, and really it's not. It's more an economic system. You got to think of it more like capitalism. Well, do we have it? Yeah. Is capitalism a government? No. It's a form of an economy, and socialism is a form of economy.
But it does seem like capitalism is becoming a form of government almost.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In our country. It's overriding everything. It's overriding our whole country, and everything that we think about, everything that we do, every action that's taken is looked at from a capitalist lens.
Yes, but see, here's, we talked about this last time, John, and, you know, I hear these people, oh, we go socialist, we've gone to hell, you know, the taxes are going to go sky high, and we're going to lose everything and all that. Well, I hate to tell you, folks, we're already socialists. We talked about this. Social Security, Medicare, all these subsidy programs for schools and farms and that's all socialism. And we've had it for years. We have had it
since the 40s.
Oh, 30s? Since the 30s.
30s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
We've had it but we're still democratic. You know, we still have civil rights. We still have constitutional rights. We still have a democratic form of government. We elect our representatives.
Is the goal of, so let's think about goals of the Republicans, and they're so anti-socialist. Would they prefer to get rid of all the socialist programs that we have here, like Medicare and Social Security, and I guess welfare? Would they want those to be completely gone? Is that the majority of the Republican viewpoint?
You know, I would like to see them try. Because I touched on this last time in the last program. It's like, I'm retirement age. You know, I get Social Security. I'm on Medicare and all that good stuff. But I would like to talk to some of the diehard Republicans, like, say, you know, retirement age like me, and say, okay, you're all against socialism. Okay, yeah. I'd like to say, okay, then how about this? How about we yank your Social Security, we yank your Medicare, because those are socialist programs.
I would really, truly like to talk to some people in that situation.
Yeah.
Some Republican diehards, and ask them that question. And you know, I think you have to have a lot of different people from different socioeconomic backgrounds to ask, too. You have to have, like, a sample of, like, 10 people that are, you know, financially, you know, and you get older. Well-off versus not. And I'm sure the well-off people would be like, yeah, get rid of it. And the people down here, all the way up to the middle, maybe even upper middle of that socioeconomic, they probably still want to keep it. But probably the people who are uber wealthy, of course they wouldn't want to keep it, right? But, I mean...
Well, they don't care.
They don't care.
But let's look at it this way. Where would we be... Let's look at education, okay? One great thing about this country, and we're not the only one, the Western cultures like France, Germany, Great Britain, Italy, and all that, we have public school systems. Okay, so everybody can at least, in this country, can at least get a high school education.
Is that socialism?
Well, subsidies. Yeah, I'm thinking.
I mean, they're getting paid by the federal government.
Yeah, they're being subsidized or you know, their deficits and whatever being made up.
That's not capitalist.
That's not capitalist that is not at capitalist. All. That's socialist.
That's socialist.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
So, okay.
You heard it here, folks.
Yeah, yeah. So like I said, okay. So if I'm a diehard Republican and I'd say, okay, yank out those school subsidies, that means maybe my grandchildren can't get a public education.
Yeah.
Because it would go back to the old days. Well, it'd be like third world countries, where only the children of those wealthy enough to pay to send their children to school.
So what was it before? Was it FDR that did all the
School subsidy? Oh yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
Before that was there?
You know,
was public
I don't
schools
know.
We'd have to go way back for
that. Yeah,
so.
I don't know. I think that was all handled on the state level, but now there's federal subsidies that come in. And like I said before, I mean, I say I thank God for student loans, because I got a doctoral degree on student loans. I couldn't have done that. I came from a lower middle class family. Mm-hmm. But because of federally subsidized, there's that word again, student loans, I was able to do that. And there are a lot of people out there just like me. It doesn't mean, it used to be, well, if you come from a lower middle class family and you don't have the money, you don't deserve to go to school. Well, yeah. What if I have the desire and the intellectual ability to do it, but I can't do it because of money? Think where we would be right now. I'll bet you anything, if you looked at a lot of the senators and congressmen, if you looked at their backgrounds, I'll bet you'd find out a lot of them did not come from privilege.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, they look like they're but they work their way up. I mean, I mean,
if you think about it, privilege, sometimes just if it doesn't make you very hungry. You know, when you're not as privileged, you're hungrier to succeed sometimes.
Sure.
You know, there's all
this
many, many different factors why people succeed.
Sure.
And you could be from privilege and be hungry too, but I think you know, a lot of it comes down to parenting, but or just
well, this
know,
is
factors,
true.
But.
Well, I think, you know, there's, you know, we're probably going to get off way the mark here, but
oh yeah,
but I think every there's a certain psychology or culture, if you will, of each socioeconomic class. And I hate to use that word, because it's kind of like putting up boundaries between
right.
these people and these people. But I think when you get desperately poor, how can the parents who are desperately poor and having a hard time, especially in this day and age with COVID, putting food on the table, are going to say, oh, this is a great country. You can be anything you want to be. And you got a kid sitting there that doesn't have, you know, maybe there's not enough heat, maybe there's not enough to eat, and you're going to tell them, oh, this is a great country, and you can just go out there and
and
do anything and be anything.
You have to believe it.
Yes, you have to
you know,
believe
the
it.
Parent that says that to their kid has to believe it.
Exactly.
And because a kid knows, well, a kid can kind of tell whether you're being genuine or not, right? And the parent is going to come off as like, well, you know, you can do whatever you want. You can be anything you want. But that's not, they don't believe it. You know?
Yeah. So the kid's sitting there thinking, okay, so why are we living like this?
Yeah, why are we living like this?
Why
yeah.
didn't you do whatever? Why couldn't you have become everything you want?
I guess that goes back to that question of what is the American dream?
Oh, yeah.
That Scott asked the other day. And
good question, by the way. Very good question.
And that I think it evolves over time. The answer to that changes. Maybe it doesn't, maybe it shouldn't, but it does seem to be changing a little bit. And everybody may have their own idea what it is. And I also saw something the other day. I think Jim Jordan said it, because I subscribe to him and Matt Gaetz and all those lovely, lovely guys. One of them said, America is not an idea, it's a place. And I was like, I don't think I agree with that. I think America is an idea. I think it is an idea, and I think it's much bigger than a place.
My argument would be Cuba's a place.
Yeah, it's America. He's like, America's our home. And it's like, yeah, it is, but America is an idea. If you really understood, you know, the American history and what we fought for and what we are, everything we fight for is ideas. Sure, I mean, of course. The Constitution and everything is ideas. And the idea of freedom of religion, the idea of freedom, all the freedoms that we have, and the ability to live the way that we live. And that's an idea. It's not a place. Yes, we have a great country and we have tons of natural resources, which is awesome. But, you know, we're kind of fortunate in that way. But I don't know. I found that to be really interesting that they would say that so blatantly. It was either Jim Jordan or Matt Gaetz. I don't remember, but, and that's how they feel, you know, it's not an idea for them. It's just this place.
Well, you know, it's to me, the idea of freedom and democracy is intangible,
right?
You know, it's like the difference, you know, when you're in school, you learn the difference between a number and a numeral. A numeral is a representation of a number, which doesn't really exist. It's a concept.
Yeah.
But it's still there. And we do it. We do complicated computations and whatever, all with things that really don't exist.
I think what the founding fathers were trying to do was think about humans. Right.
True. Oh, yeah.
Let's think about, forget our country. Like, what is the basic human need? What are the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
Yeah.
Right. Every human wants that, I would say. I mean, I think that that's why it is an idea, not a place, because they're trying to define what it is that humans need.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's why the world has always revered the United States in some way, shape, or form. For those ideals, mm-hmm. and they've gotten distorted over the years, but I think the idea of America is huge, and I think the original idea of it was just that. It was hope, was life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, and you know, a newer country sprouting up a kind of as a rebellion against England, right?
Oh, sure.
So it's just I don't know. It's,
you know, I think a few years ago, Tony Blair, when he was Prime Minister of Great Britain, in fact, he was the Prime Minister of Great Britain about the time that George H. Bush was president.
Yeah,
but I remember him. But Tony Blair, I remember, I saw Tony Blair on an interview one time, and it really kind of struck home with me, and he said, look, say what you want about the United States, but the fact is everybody wants to go there.
There's an intangible feeling.
Yeah, there's something. There's something about the United States that everybody wants to come here. I mean, to the extent that we're talking about closing borders and all that, which I vehemently oppose. But you know,
closing borders to certain people. Yes, I think there's definitely. I don't mind tight borders. I think tight borders is okay. I think we should be more cognizant of who's coming and going.
Yeah, but I don't like Trump's. I mean, I understand where Trump's coming from. He wants to cut it. He wants to stop the flow of people coming up through Mexico from South America and all that. Okay, so he wants to build this wall to keep Mexicans and South Americans out. But what about all the ones that come here from Europe, from Asia? I mean, from Canada, for Christ's sake, why don't we have barriers to keep everybody out? I mean, if we're going to keep the southern borders so tight that we don't let anybody in, why we still have three other ways into this country? There's east, west, and north.
It's a ridiculous concept from get go. It's an idea. If it's a symbol of. It's sort of a somewhat racist symbol. I don't know, racist, but you're only sort of wanting to prevent certain people from coming in.
Exactly. Exactly.
Brown skin people or Mexicans or Muslims. I think Muslims too, you know, and he had a Muslim ban. He actually had a Muslim ban.
Yeah, on Muslims.
Yeah, on Muslims. Yeah. On a religious, if you're of a religious type of person, you come here, you can't come. It's like, whoa, you know, that's not what we're about. But I do think that everybody should go through the same process. You can visit, you can apply for citizenship. You can go through that route. I think we should be, I think we should be a little stricter on that. And I, you know, because other, you know, other countries, it's not so easy to become a citizen, you know, and I agree with that. I think it should be harder. I think it, but I don't know. It may have gotten a little out of whack during Obama's term. I think he was a little bit more open about it. Yeah. And that's one of the few things that I was less happy about. Because it's not fair to the people that went through the process where people are coming in, either illegally or just are cheating the system. It's not cool. You know,
shouldn't
cheat the system.
Who's to say that, okay, I know my paternal grandparents came here from Germany through Ellis Island. They came here, as far as I know, legally.
Yeah.
But the rest of my family, I don't know. I mean, who's to say that I didn't have some that snuck here from Ireland or whatever illegally? I don't know that.
I guess it's and that's okay, but it's just like you don't want to encourage it.
I think
you send a signal out to not encourage that kind of, like, I think that's fine that, if people get in and then, like I live in California for over 20 years and a lot of Mexicans there.
Oh,
a lot of illegals, a lot of it. No, I hate that's a bad term, really, legal, but it kind of technically what it is, but, they didn't go through the process. They've been living there undocumented, basically. And
but I'll bet they've been working and paying taxes.
They work so hard. I'll tell you what, they work so hard. And I worked in property management, and I always had a lot of Mexican people around me, and they always had two or three jobs, and it would work 20 hours a day.
And
tireless, and it's a cultural thing. They work hard, and then the whole idea that Mexicans are lazy is ridiculous. It's insane.
It's funny, I've been to Germany a number of times, and I know one time we were talking about that, and they were saying, since the Berlin Wall fell, what a problem. I had a hard time to keep from laughing because some of these were relatives. But people are pouring in from Russia and all this stuff, and they don't have jobs, and they immediately apply for welfare. And all they do is lay around, get drunk, and all that. And I said, I think I've heard of that before. but by the same token, the Turks are, I look at the Turks being to Germany as what, say, Mexicans are to the U.S. They don't want, it was like, they're illegal and all that stuff, but I'll tell you what, they don't have any problem eating in the Turkish snack bars and restaurants, or hiring the Turks to do their yard, their gardening
familiar.
Or whatever. And I thought, man, that sounds real familiar. So, we don't want them there, but it's funny. And they work their butts off. They work their cans off.
Yeah. How do we end up there? I don't know, but, we were talking about socialism, and I think Jake is coming soon, so we could take a little break. Unless is there any other points that you'd like to talk about with socialism? Or
no, I was going to start talking about communism, but I don't think we're going to have.
That's probably like a 30-minute talk.
Maybe we'll save that for another day.
Yeah, and I just, one thing on communism is, again, with the purposefully misinforming politicians out there saying that we're going to become communist if we vote for Democrats. It's infuriating. No Democrats anywhere are talking about communism. No one is. It's a lie. It's a blatant lie, and they know it. Maybe they don't know it. Maybe they don't know the difference between communism and other types of socialism. Maybe they don't. That's the issue. Say they really think that communism is the only type of socialism or whatever. And they don't even realize that we're like 30-40% socialism in our country. They don't know.
And that socialism can't cannot exist with democracy. That is bull. I mean, there are we are a socialist democracy, folks.
We kind of are.
That's right. I said it. Yeah. But we're not the only one. You know, you got Great Britain, Sweden, Finland, the Scandinavian states. You know, they're all over the place, and they're still democratic. They're free democratic countries.
I just wish that people could get over that negative term. It's really, you know, we're already there. Okay, just accept it. We already with the amount of money that go from taxes that goes to Medicare and Social Security, we're kind of already a little bit socialist country. So, I'm not saying I want to be a socialist country like full blown. I'm not saying I want the government to run our health care and education. I'm not saying I want the government to run. We need private business. We need competition. We need capitalism. It's all great. Okay.
Yeah.
On that note, let's take a break and let's get Jake in here. All right.
Let's do it. All right.
See you in a bit. Okay, we made it back. We are back with Jake. I just say Jake because I don't know if you want to have your full name disclosed on this.
No, Jake is fine.
But honestly, your father-in-law has already given all your details. So
that's great.
It's too late.
Yeah, so this is Sergeant Cash. I've talked about before. He's done military his career. He was regular Army and 3rd Infantry at Fort Myer. Did honor funerals at Arlington National Cemetery. And then when he got out, he went in Army National Guard. Now he's the non-commissioned officer in charge of the Lebanon, Indiana armory. And, of course, he is quite well-versed in military code. So I thought when we talked at the last podcast, excuse me, that it would be great to have somebody on the show that really knows the rules and regulations, like, you know, what are militias, how are they used, what can the president do, all that. And Jake is our man, and it's good to have you here, Jake.
No, thank you.
One thing we were talking about is we've had mixed sources. When John and I first started looking into militias, he and I both came up with there's about 53, and then I did a little more research, and it said there's 165, and then you found out there's more like 225 or so throughout the country. So could you kind of tell us historically what is a militia, like from the beginning, from 1776, what was it intended to be, and what has it become?
Okay, so we're going to go a little bit before 1776. In 1636 is when the Continental Congress authorized the formation of militias for the colonies to protect them from Indians or Native Americans or whatever. And that's what the National Guard is today. So the original militias that when the word militia comes out is what is now known as the National Guard today. Now, each state has what we call a state defense force, and in Indiana, it's called the Indiana Guard Reserve. And their job is more, they're state-funded completely, 100%. And they're an all-volunteer force. They do a lot of things like search and rescue kind of things. They're trained in emergency management to assist local governments with, you know, a missing person or even flooding. But most of their stuff is centered around smaller type things. And they're also there to help assist the National Guard. If we were to deploy, they would be there to assist us through our
state
deployment.
This is the state guard.
Yes.
And they are under the direction of the National Guard.
No, they have no national level. The National Guard is controlled by the governor of the state that they belong to and the president. So
the U.S. National Guard is what?
Is guys wearing an Army uniform, says U.S. Army on their uniform just like everyone else. Now, the State Defense Force They are a paramilitary organization, and they have uniforms, they have training, not near as extensively as somebody in the National Guard or the Army Reserves. And they're solely controlled by the governor of Indiana or their state.
Okay, so there is nothing above the state level on these particular groups?
And they are a government-established entity. Now, the militias that get talked a lot about today...
Well, before we go into that, I want to understand... I was doing a little bit of research earlier about National Guard. I've never really understood it. I never really knew much about it. And now, and now there's state guards too.
Yes.
And I read that the U.S. National Guard is sort of is like the umbrella of all the state guards.
Okay. So we
have.
Is that
true or not?
There's a distinction between them. So let's talk more about let's talk about kind of the military and how it's set up.
Okay.
So Title 10 of the U.S. Code establishes the armed forces of the United States.
Okay.
Title 32, which I believe was, and please don't quote me on this, I believe it was right after World War II, it was enacted to establish the National Guard as its current formation as it is today. And the National Guard has a seat on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So they have a four-star general that serves with the Army four-star, et cetera, Marine, Air Force. And they provide guidance and regulation to the states. And then each state has a National Guard, actually, and the territories. So we have 54 different National Guards throughout the country. Indiana, I believe, is the fifth or sixth largest one in the country. Hmm. And for being a little bit lower on the population scale, we have a lot of people serving in our state.
That's Indiana awesome. For you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, so then there's a subsect that has no federal governance whatsoever called the State Defense Forces.
Mm. Okay. So they're separate.
Right.
Got it.
Okay. And they're controlled solely by the governor. Whereas the National Guard.
So state, let's talk about State Defense Force. But you work for the National Guard.
Yes.
But let's talk about State Defense Forces for a minute. Can you talk much about that? Are you familiar with it?
Excuse me. I have a little bit of dealings with them. We see them a lot during May activities around the race. They do a lot of traffic control in Indianapolis for the mini marathon and the memorial service down on the circle. They do a lot of that stuff. These guys also help out with missing persons. I know that the Spear Girl.
Are they armed?
No.
They're not?
No.
And they don't do training, any sort of military training that's not, it's not that sort of thing. Like where U.S. National Guard there is paramilitary type training.
The U.S. National Guard, the Indiana National Guard, we are fully trained.
Fully trained. But the State Guard is not.
No. Okay. They go through some first aid training. They go through some training, but they're not typically armed. They don't have an arsenal.
Okay.
And they serve.
That's a good distinction. I just wanted to get that clear because I was unsure about that. And it sounds like every state has their own state guard. And then there's National Guard in each state, too, that sort of proliferates.
Yeah, I was going to say this is fascinating, Jake, because I didn't know there was any such thing as state guard. That's news to me.
So these are sponsored, government-sponsored groups.
Yes.
Right? These are legitimate groups.
Yes.
And so we're going to transition to some of the groups that are a little less legitimate, which are considered what. So I just read today. I'm just going to give you I realized that every single state in this country, it's illegal to have paramilitary activities.
Privatized, yes.
Privatized,
absolutely.
Yeah, privatized paramilitary activities. And apparently there's. How many groups?
There are several out there. There are a handful of national ones. And then I have a list here. In 2016, they said 165 groups, and it's back on the rise.
Yeah.
Okay.
So because from 2016 on, it's gone up. I wonder why.
Yeah. Anyway, go ahead. Because the source that I had, see, this is where it's a little confusing. I think when John and I both looked into this, we said there was 53, and then I found out in researching this, I said 165.
I think it was Wikipedia that said 53, and Wikipedia is always you have to kind of like
right.
Not sure.
Well, this one was know your neighborhood militia group
or .com.
.com. And it said 165. And Jake, what number did you come
so
up with?
So the Southern Poverty Law Center, I believe out of Birmingham,
yes,
lists 165 as of 2016. I don't
okay,
have any.
Sounds like 165 is okay. Is a
that's
of
2016.
Number.
What are we? Where are we at now, Jake?
That we don't have a firm number on.
Well, that's an interesting thing in itself because I think in the last 4 years, maybe there's either more members of the existing militias or there's been some new militias, but we don't have that information.
Right. Can't think of them. The guys that are prevalent right now, the
Proud Boys.
The Proud Boys.
Or the Boogaloos.
I would say that's probably one that would be added to the list. I don't know.
That's a new one. That would be a new one, you think, maybe?
I would think so. Yeah. But the Oath Keepers is a national level one. A lot of former military.
That was the one that I referenced before in a previous podcast. And I did some research on them. And those are the guys that seem to be sort of the security forces at some of the Trump rallies.
And I believe one of the leaders of the Oath Keepers just recently in the past couple days made a statement to the president saying that they'll fight a bloody rebellion if he
They're talking about civil war. Civil war, yes. Yeah. They're the ones that are very, very pro civil war, and they want it. You know, they're just gearing up for it, you know. But I don't know how many members there are in the Oath Keepers. I think I did a little search on total members of all militias, right? Like, this is what I was really interested in before was how many people are we talking about here? You're talking about 50,000, 100,000?
I have read and seen anywhere between 10 to 60,000.
In the entire country?
In the entire country belong to some sort of privatized militia.
That sounds about right. I saw 20 to 60, I think it was. And it's hard to know because it's like nothing's really documented.
Right.
But 20 to 60. So when you look at the 350 million people and how much press and how much stuff that we're hearing about these like extremist groups and like how few that is, really 50,000 people is really not that much. They can do a lot of damage.
Oh, absolutely.
But it's not the general public. You know, and it's like we're sort of like, you know, the media loves a story, you know, and like how important are these militias? Like how big of a threat are they?
I really think they could be a viable threat, especially a group like the Oath Keepers who are constitutionalists. They're pretty far right wing, but they are constitutionalists. They want to preserve the Constitution, but they are also former military, former police.
In their own view of the Constitution. Yeah.
And,
right?
Yes. Like, and, you know, so they're well-trained.
Yeah. But how do you see that playing out? Like, what kind of skirmishes are we talking about here? I mean, they're skirmishes. They're not, there's no front. There's no civil war. It doesn't exist. That's not even a thing.
No, right? I don't think they'll be able to amass themselves enough in a concentrated area to really be an effect on anything. But you know,
it could be domestic terrorism.
One of the leaders is threatening. So
yeah, the guy with the eye patch.
No,
you know the guy with the eye patch, the Oath Keepers.
No,
well,
he's kind of the spokesperson as far as I know.
Is that who said it?
There's a guy with an eye patch.
No, there's what. I found really bizarre about the Oath Keepers. Okay. That, my friends, was founded by a Yale Law School graduate, Stuart Rhodes, in 2009. And the group now claims 30,000 members, and specifically They love this. Recruits and former members of the military and law enforcement.
The fact that they're national, too, is a little unusual. Yeah. Like, most of these places are somewhat local.
Well, they're only one of the big three here.
Are there other national groups?
Oh, this one. Gotta love this one. Of course, we know about the Proud Boys. We've talked about them.
Yeah, yeah. It's, can you remind Jake of the three main tenements of their you got to be a chauvinist.
Yeah,
you got to be white supremacist, and you have to be a male.
Well, neo-fascist.
Neo-fascist.
You forgot. Oh,
sorry, neo-fascist. You know, sorry,
John. I thought I did a better job with you. The 3%, like the Oath Keeper, 3% are Second Amendment activists in one of the most well-known militia groups. Their network is less centralized. These are more like Antifa. These are
subgroups.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, like, Antifa is the umbrella term for all the super left-wing extremist groups.
And right? What this is,
there is no term for the umbrella. I guess militia. Maybe it's militia.
Yeah, militia.
Maybe that's it.
I don't know. Jake can do a better job with defining militia than I. But
because it's changing its definition in some ways. Because a militia and originally, let's talk about the original idea of militia, right?
So, yeah. Back in 1636, the Continental Congress told these authorized the states and basically told able-bodied men to have themselves armed and be prepared to respond, to protect their town, protect their city. And they shortly thereafter started having drills where they would actually do stuff in the town square.
Like military exercises?
Yeah, drilling ceremonies.
This is sort of at the request of the current government, though, right?
Of the Continental Congress, yes.
The Continental still Congress, yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Which was treasonous and whatever, and was still...
treasonous to the other side, but...
Yeah, treasonous.
At the time, the militias were not. The militias back in 1636 were actually promoted by the British government and the monarchy to protect the colonies.
Yeah, yeah.
And as time grew and frustrations grew with the colony or with the British rule, that's when the militias ended up kind of backfiring on the British government.
Well, okay, that's...
Wait, back up. Tell me again. I sort of missed that.
Go ahead, John.
So the militias were at the direction of the British government?
Yeah, back when we were colonies. And the
before we were a country,
right?
So they were saying the militias. So the militias were sort of pro Britain.
Well, they were there to protect the colonies, absolutely. Right. Oh, yeah. And you know, this is 140 years before the American Revolution, and as time goes, 140 years, that's several generations.
That's a lot.
and those. Minutemen, as they were called, because they were able to respond within a minute, and that's one of the icons of the National Guard is that Minuteman with a rifle in one hand and standing beside an old fashioned plow.
We have nuclear missiles named after them, the Minuteman,
right? And so as we went along and we started seeking that independence and stuff, it's that same militia that stood up in 1776. Yeah. To fight for that independence.
So the idea of it is positive, right? It's, I mean, and I was talking to Tom about this earlier, about the idea of America in general is rebellion.
Absolutely.
Right? It's rebellion, and guns are a part of that.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that's really hard to root that out. I don't want to change the direction of this conversation, but it is...
You're not.
Well... It is, the whole reason why we're here is because of these kind of things that we're talking about, right? These people that brought up that cared so much to become militia minutemen, right? They cared about this idea that we're fighting for,
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And we had to break free from the British to become our own independent state. And part of the Constitution, and I'm not a gun person, I'm not like a pro-gun person, but like I understand that America is rooted in guns, you know, like we're it's in our, it's like the second,
this is,
you know,
this is true.
Second Amendment
and a huge population of Americans that have more than one firearm. And,
let you me know, just back,
when it goes okay. to firearms, the to me, the most important thing is training. One of the other things I do is I volunteer with 4-H, among other organizations, and through the shooting sports programs, we teach 100 kids every year how to safely use firearms and their parents.
I guess what I'm saying is back then, we're a young country, right?
We are.
And we became a country after guns had been created. A lot of the older countries in Europe and everything, they were created long, long, long before guns were created. And so they're not gun countries, right?
Right.
Like they don't have policemen carrying guns. But we are rooted in that and rebellious nature. And it's really hard to uproot that from us. And I don't know. I just think that it's complicated. I think it's complicated because we are a new country and we're not the same as Europe. You know, we're fighting for freedom. We're unique. You know, we're different.
We are.
And I don't know how to, I don't really know where I'm going with this. I'm sort of losing my track, but it's, you know, it is complicated. It you know, and I think everybody has to understand how hard it was for America to become America. I think, and I'm not a pro-gun person, but I understand people that are, especially early on in the country. Nowadays, maybe not so much. Maybe I don't feel it's as important now as it was then.
Well, John, I think what you have to remember, a gun was an essential part of life then.
Exactly.
You used the gun set by the front door and whatever, but you didn't just, the main purpose of the gun was not to kill people or to kill invaders. It was for supper. You used essential tool. You went out and hunted game. And mm-hmm. whatever, and it just became a part of
the essential tool. That's a good way of looking at it. Yep.
An essential tool. Mm-hmm. And then when I was going to mention this now, the father of our country, George Washington, was an officer in the British Continental Militia. And he fought against the French, but he left the militia in 1769 because of taxation without representation. So he was a militiaman, but he was a British militiaman. But the gun has just been, it's been a tool, and it's like we've had a hard time letting go of the tool.
Well, yeah, you know? And it is rooted in our heritage. It is rooted, unlike any other country. You know, we're a very new country. We're one of the newest countries, and it's hard to uproot that. But I think that's I think we all need to have an honest conversation about, like, do we need them now? But it's too late. It might be too late because you're going to let the bad guys have them and the good guys can't. I don't think you can do that. You know, so we just might be stuck with it.
Gun control.
We're stuck with guns.
Gun control is another subject for another day. That gets so complicated, but it's not. I don't think it's going to change. I
think we're stuck with them. Is what it is. I think we're stuck with them, and we got to have a relationship with them.
Exactly.
I think then Jake's perspective is that you teach your kids how to use them, and you deal with it, and you understand it because bad guys are always going to have them here.
Absolutely.
And so the good guys should have them too.
Well, you know, one thing,
and it's just the way America is. Sorry.
One thing I pointed out to my German friends a few years ago, in America, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's easier to get a gun permit than it is to get a driver's license. A driver's license, you have to take a test and you have to prove your competence. But to get a gun license, you just have to prove that you're not.
Tom, we've been blabbing a lot, but I haven't heard anything from Jake for a while. So let's let him respond a little bit.
Tom's right. Well, for some people, it's very easy. The problem with most of the gun control, before we get back to what we were talking about, is that the current laws aren't practiced and enforced the way they should be. I at one point in my military career, I had a top secret security clearance that allowed me into the White House. Because of all my background investigations that I've had for security clearances in the military, when I go to a gun store and they process my background check, it pings because I've had too many full investigations. I have a really hard time personally being able to buy
it. You're a person of interest.
Wow.
You're a person of interest.
That is amazing.
When a few years ago with 4-H, we got a bunch of new rifles from the NRA grant. The NRA Foundation does a wonderful thing for youth shooting sports and raises a lot of money for them. And I went to this guy who is a dealer for the legal transfer of the firearm, and it came back unspecified, and he didn't feel comfortable letting me sign for these guns from him. And I was blown away. I'm like, 10 years ago, I could walk into the White House.
Yeah. That's crazy.
People, you have to understand that when Jake was regular Army, he guarded the doors to the White House when the dignitaries arrived. He did military funerals in Arlington National Cemetery. He had the top security clearance, and now he's having a hard time because he was too good. He was his clearance was too high, and they're thinking, my gosh, there's been too many inquiries.
Yeah, so I don't know what actually, but after I think 3 days or a week, the gentleman was allowed to say, okay, well, the FBI didn't come back and say no. Man. But just because it didn't come back yes or no, he didn't feel comfortable having me sign for him. So I had to have another, adult volunteer for 4-H go down and sign for him.
Well, you know, Jake, what bothers me, I don't want to get off on gun control.
Right.
Okay, here I am. I'm not a threat to anybody, seemingly, but I can go out and right now I can buy a weapon because I'm going to pass the background test and all that. I can get automatic weapons. I mean, not fully automatic. I can make them fully automatic. I can go out and kill a bunch of people, but you, as former military, as a responsible individual, with the highest clearance, have a hard time getting. I don't understand that.
And that's where I get back to saying that a lot of the things that we have issues with in our nation is a lack of the proper protocols of the current laws being enforced and being run properly. That's why people with, you see these mass shootings that we've had in the past, and it always comes back to them having some sort of mental disorder, but they were able to still get a firearm easily.
Yes, exactly.
Whether they
how
took
do you feel
them from
about
their
that?
Parents. I think that's where that background check needs to come in. I know that HIPAA gets into all of this, health information privacy. I get that. But when it comes to responsible gun ownership, if you're not responsible, then you probably shouldn't have a firearm.
It should be a lot harder to get a gun here. Yeah. I think it should be, you should definitely have a background check. I think, I got a gun. I have a gun. I have a handgun. It's a Springfield XD9.
So I'm such an old hippie, I don't even have one.
Yeah, I have one.
But that's cool.
It's not really the best safety, but I have one. But I'm not I'm not a pro gun person, but ideally I think it'd be better if we weren't a gun loving country, I think, but we are. But the reality is that we are. And so I think that everybody that is sort of anti-gun, it's, I don't think you're going to be able to change the core of our country. It's really going to be hard to do that. I think it's possible.
Amendment number one says something about freedom of speech. Amendment number two talks about the right to bear arms.
Yeah, that's how important it was back then.
It's like number one, number two, and it's right there. And the thing is, I think we ought to let Jake talk a little bit more about militias and the military and all that, because we've really...
Well, thanks, Tom, for bringing it back.
I think when you talk about the threats from the Oath Keepers about a civil war or rebellion or whatever, I think that's where we need to be a little concerned. Because they, in their mind, are looking at how they interpret the Constitution. Because, you know, even with like martial law, which we can get into here in a little bit, there's no clear cut anything in U.S. code about martial law. There's only very little Supreme Court.
Why is it called martial law? Did anybody know that?
So originally, martial law would have meant military law.
Oh, yeah, like you're at war or something.
Well, no. So martial law, which in the last 80, 90 years, we've had very little actual martial law in the United States. Probably the biggest was Hawaii. After the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the United States Army took over territory. They took over Hawaii. They were responsible for everything from trash to law enforcement, the whole gamut. They were running the whole thing for several years, and that's truly what martial law is when the military, the government, the military takes over for a local government because they are not doing
right.
They're not running their city, their
How
state.
How is it declared? Is it? Who can declare martial law?
So,
is it the president, or is it Congress, or what is how does
and,
that
and
how
that's
that
where
declare?
It got, that's where it got really fuzzy for me. I read this.
You can't figure it out. Yeah,
I read this article from Joseph Nunn from the Brennan Center for Law.
Yeah,
and he's I've got these papers that John can see. I mean, this is.
Yeah,
15 pages of footnotes of him citing all his sources and the different cases from the Supreme Court and other U.S. courts, and martial law. The way I think people think of martial law, I don't think the president or Congress has true power to do that. And that
so comes, you're saying that there is no true understanding of how martial law is declared.
Right, because like even earlier this year with like all the rioting and protests and stuff.
You were talking about
when the National Guard was there, that's not martial law. When soldiers are called out to assist with stuff like that, the military calls it defense support of civil authorities. We work for an agency. We do not take control of a situation. We work strictly for it. An agency. So if the National Guard is called out for show of force for a protest, just to kind of make
keep
sure
the peace,
keep the peace kind
yeah,
of
yeah,
stuff,
yeah.
You know, they're under the control and guidance of the city police department or the state police, or, you know, in other situations with flooding or even with the current situation with COVID, we've got over 2,000 soldiers in the state of Indiana that are working at nursing homes and testing facilities, helping administer tests, helping. We've got them now starting to help with vaccines. They are not working. They're not in charge. The Department of Health is in charge of those guys, giving them their direction.
State or federal.
In this case right now, each state's Department of Health, with the people that are working at the nursing homes, the long-term care facilities and stuff, those guys are probably the ones pushing the direction as the state level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like state level, as far as COVID goes, is very state-oriented direction with COVID.
It is. And with a lot of things, I'd like to see more of the state involved.
Yeah.
And less of that centralized government. Let the states do what they've done for you know, decades upon decades, and have done a really good job until a lot of times federal government comes in and says,
that's an interesting philosophy too, like the idea of states in an umbrella country, federal, right? Like the United States. It's, you know, you can almost look at it like Europe.
Right.
You know, the United States of Europe.
Well, the European Union.
Right. But they're very different. It's totally different, obviously, because they're they've ancient societies, whatever. You know, but America has these states that were sort of arbitrarily chosen and divided arbitrarily back in, you know, back way back when. By rivers or by, you know, whatever. And that is so impactful now. And look at our elections and things like that, like how states have, individual states have so much power. And I don't know how I feel about that. I'm not sure how I feel about states having more power or centralized power. To me, it's a little complicated because we are a country. We're supposed to be united, but our states are very different.
And they are. And that's, you know, that's why, one, we rebelled back in the 1700s from the British, because we were so much different than them in our lifestyle. And that's what caused the Civil War. You know, any people will say, oh, it was all about slavery. No, it wasn't. It was about the states' rights to control things. Now,
the main reason for the states' rights was slavery, I would say,
and that can be argued. Absolutely,
yes, it could be.
Yeah,
but I believe that it was mostly slavery because it's a culture. It's a culture, right? Like the idea of having a slave versus not having a slave is hugely different. It is a dividing line in a person. I don't know. Maybe I've gone too far.
But, you know, it is these things, and you know, the fight over, it's like college rivalries even, you know.
But what are we fighting? So right now, okay, so what are we fighting for right now? Democrat versus Republican, Republican, I mean, Trump versus Democrat. Trump versus Democrat. What are we fighting for? What are the differences in these parties? What are the main differences, would you say?
You know,
what is a Trumper fighting for that a Democrat is not fighting for? I don't know. It's a hard question. I'm sorry to catch you off guard. I know you were talking about militias and everything, but I don't know. That's why this podcast is called Common Ground, because I feel like we actually are wanting most of the same things. It's just that, you know, the manipulation of the media and all that has sort of made us feel different, but we're not really that different, you know?
Well, you know, I think, John, that a lot of what you're asking about does go back to the quote militias. And this is what bothers me is, and Jake, correct me if I'm wrong, because you being a member of the military, you are trained in these things, you know. But what bothers me is militias originally were true citizen soldiers, right?
Yes.
It's like, you know, if you were a farmer in Pennsylvania and you got the call, you know, some guy riding on a horse says, take up your guns and head east, you would do it. And it was government sanctioned, government controlled. Today, to me, the term militia has been so bastardized. I mean, because
there are multiple definitions.
Multiple definitions, but what bothers me is originally militias were government backed and government in a lot of ways controlled citizen soldiers. And today it's like they're anti-government. They've become the antithesis of what militias originally were, and now it's like we're anti-government. You know, we're going to fight the taxes. We're not going to pay our taxes. We're not going to do that.
And Confederacy and, was a four-year.
Yeah, exactly. But that's what gets me. Like initially, militias were the defenders of the country,
right?
And but now they're like anti. Country.
But in their eyes, in these organizations' eyes, they're trying to restore the nation back to the Constitution. They feel that we've fallen so far away from our Constitution and some of the things that we do, you know, these spending
their
bills
interpretation
and stuff,
of it is different. Yeah.
They feel called to, you know, the Oath Keepers.
Oh, yeah.
They're military people. Our oath is to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Yeah.
They're still keeping their oath, even though they're not serving anymore. And some of them probably are serving.
Yeah, I guess it's like what...
So they feel that the Constitution's being violated, and that's the number one part.
And I would like to get down into the details of that. Like what are they talking about specifically that is so... wrong that makes them want to take up arms. Like I would like to like go down the list of things that they find to be, you know, wrong. You know, like I don't know what they are.
I think things like gun control. They don't want that 2A to be affected. They want to protect the Second Amendment. Okay. Things like the immigration issues. You know, whether it's legal or illegal, however they're coming in, there's issues with that they feel that the current government, not necessarily the president,
but the
government as a whole, the federal government, is violating the Constitution, especially when they make laws to pardon or give clemency to illegal immigrants or voting rights to them, things like that. So there's that. There's...
Yeah.
You know, the taxation, the social programs, and
well,
you know, we're always going to have social programs. We should always take care of our own, but that's
well, we
kind
were
of
talking
a problem
about
with
that earlier.
Spending bill is that we're not really taking care of our own that much.
Right. Yeah, well, we were talking about that earlier with like currently our system is we have Social Security, we have Medicare. Those are socialist programs, right? Those are pretty much socialist, and we've all accepted that, right? Like a lot of people have. Would the Oath Keepers say we don't want Social Security and we don't want Medicare?
Do you think? And that was a big thing. A lot of people found a lot of the New Deal things that FDR did,
yeah,
to pull us out of the Great Depression were against the Constitution.
But what do you think?
And there's
you
always
think
been
that,
an argument.
Do you think that the Oath Keepers would say, no, we don't want any Medicare and we don't want any Social Security?
Probably. I think a lot of people say they, you know, you should earn it just like everybody
if
else.
If their parents are in their 70s and they're getting Social Security and Medicare, take it away from them and see how they feel.
But Social Security, when it was originally stood up, it was an opt-in.
Right,
it was an opt-in for a citizen.
It's just the place where we are now.
Right,
yeah,
right?
It was like, actually supposed to be a supplement to individual retirement programs, but
I think we all want free market. We all want we all want us to be go getters, competitive people. Like everybody wants to work hard. I think in this country, right. Nobody wants to just sit back. I mean, there are a lot of people that do now. And I don't know what it's like in truly socialist countries. Do people take advantage of that?
Well,
I don't know.
You know, here's what gets me. It's like we are a socialist democracy. We have been for years. Between Medicare, we always say Medicare, Medicaid, but we forget about farm subsidies, school subsidies, and all that. And student loans, like I was, I said earlier, I would not have had, I would not have aspired to degree of doctor if it hadn't been for student loans. I came from lower middle class, so we are a socialist democracy.
it does seem like there are some things that we should consider.
I can't disagree with that. Absolutely.
Like we need to take it case by case. And we don't do that anymore. Now we just brand it socialism, capitalism, da-da-da-da. Everything is like big, and it's not we've lost our – that's why I like this podcast stuff, because we can talk about it in detail, right?
Right.
And get to the granular stuff, which is really important. It's that's what it's all about, and having long-term, long-form discussions versus like having little tweets and like, oh, this is bad, that's good. And like, that doesn't mean anything, you know, like shit is complicated, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. But Jake, one thing I was going to ask you about, I don't know. I had to take a little break there. I'm old. I can't help it.
It's okay, buddy.
Yeah, thank you.
Hot.
But martial law, have we talked about martial law yet?
Yes. We started to talk about it a little bit.
We tried to define it, but it's hard.
And according to this guy, there is no legal definition of martial law. And the term martial law is derived from military law,
right?
Which if you interpret it that way, then you would probably consider the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is the military's laws, rules, and regulations of conduct.
UCMJ.
And UCMJ, yeah, absolutely. That is what the term martial law would actually mean.
And one of the most important things of martial law is who can enact it.
And
we don't know.
What I've read, what I've looked for is something definitive. You know, obviously after Pearl Harbor, the federal government mandated the army to take control over the Hawaiian Islands.
Just as Lincoln did after the attack on Fort Sumter. I mean,
right.
Similarly, yes.
But federally, there's been no real imposition of federal troops since the 60s with desegregation.
Yes.
Well, they did have some Oregon. They threw some troops out in Oregon, I think.
But they were probably actually National Guardsmen.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, Jay.
So because that's where that comes into play. And that's what gives and that was probably a governor, the governor of Oregon,
mm-hmm. yeah,
issuing his troops, which he has the right to do to defend the state.
Because there were some zones in Seattle and Portland that became like anarchist,
right? You
know? And they decided after a while, just like, okay, we've had enough of that.
It's got to stop,
right?
Well, yeah, it's really party's over, guys.
And so you know. Like Hurricane Katrina, that response, initially, there was a lot of federalized troops there.
You being one of them.
Well, I went down as under Title 32 auspices, which is National Guard.
Oh, okay, yeah, I'm sorry.
But there were Title 10, which is Armed Forces Code, which is your active duty and your Army Reserve, Navy Reserve, Marine Corps Reserve, et cetera, components. There were some active duty folks down there initially just because they were able to respond so quickly. But there was no martial law. Yes, they were protecting property. They were protecting buildings, but they weren't enforcing laws.
And martial law, once again, is?
So martial law, the best way to define it is when an active military takes complete control over government activities.
Exactly.
So what does that look like? Can Civil you describe activities. Like a net, like what is that?
So
look and feel like.
So that would be all 11,000 soldiers in the Indiana National Guard taking control of the streets, the city county building in Indianapolis.
Are you not allowed to drive? Are people not allowed to drive around?
Oh,
are you supposed to stay in your homes?
Yeah,
you're going to get like checked everywhere you go.
They if it's true martial law, yeah, habeas corpus is.
The military has the right to do whatever they want.
However, the posse comit, I can't pronounce these Latin words.
Comitatus.
That's the initial militia.
Well, no, that actually prevents the federal government from using federal troops to respond in the country. Earlier, John and I were talking about what's called defense supportive civil authorities, and that's what you're seeing with all these National Guard troops out that we saw at riots, lining the streets as a presence to keep peace.
Okay,
that's what we're seeing at long-term care facilities, nursing homes.
Right.
Yeah. So let me ask you something,
Jake. Testing, administering vaccines.
As an active officer, have you been deployed to deal with riots?
And me personally, no.
Okay. I was curious if you had had any interactions with like riots or anything like out of control protests or things like
that. No. And luckily, the Indiana National Guard really did not have to respond to anything that got violent.
Yeah, Indiana's not too bad compared to some of the other places.
Well, but there was only one National Guard unit was called up in the Vietnam War, and that was from Indiana.
Oh, well, yeah.
Well, I got to say, Indiana is probably the most important state in the Union.
But you got to remember, this state is only, 6.5 million, and we've got
8 million.
11,000 National Guard. That's a lot of guard.
Indiana has historically had one of the highest percentages of persons serving in the military, not just the National Guard, but all branches of service.
Oh, in regular, you're talking about regular service.
There are per capita more Hoosiers serving than almost any other state.
Good people.
Wow. Yeah.
I always felt like Indiana's been a selfless, very patriotic state. Indianapolis has
patriotic
some,
is a little bit of a that word has become a little loaded these days.
Well, same thing with the patriot, word militia, right?
Patriot. Yeah, it's like important to talk about these words. Like, but it's important because some people say I'm a patriot. Like, now that's starting to mean a Trumper. You know, like, whoa. And also another thing I want to just say real quick is I feel like the American flag has become associated with Trump. And I hate that because, like, America is America. When I lived in California in the last year, we had our stroller. We'd go down to our little town that we would go to, and we had American flags coming out, and we'd just cruising around, and Lukey's, like, flashing his American flag. It wasn't July 4th or anything. It was just a normal day. We're just like, yeah, let's just show That's some cool. patriotism, whatever. And people are looking at us like, whoa, what are those guys? Those guys, like, are, what's wrong with them? You know, it's like, because the American flag has become a symbol of something other than America now, right now. And I'm just telling you because that's how I felt. And I was like, you know what? And I want to reclaim it. It's like, forget, it's not about Trump. It's about America.
It is.
It's not about Trump. Mm-hmm. It's freaking America. And the problem is that there's certain people out there that are melding the two, and I don't like that.
And yeah, it's horrible because that flag stands for so much. There's so much meaning to that flag, and I can hear arguments of why the flag needs to be changed. No, it doesn't need to be changed.
Why would it need to be changed?
You know. You hear arguments that it still stands for slavery because that's the flag that slavery was under. No.
Bullshit.
It's the evolution of our country. It's the evolution of us as people.
No.
You know, even when our country was founded, there was people who were against slavery, but there was people who profited from slavery so much. And one of the amazing things is out of the millions and millions of people that were brought across the Atlantic Ocean, most of them did not come to the United States. About 10% of them actually came to the United States. So it's not just a
problem. I've never actually thought about the flag relation to slavery. I just never even thought it was an issue. I never even realized that was a thing.
Yeah, and
I that's the first time I've heard it.
Really?
Yeah.
It was when all the statues started being taken down and stuff. There was talk about the flag being offensive.
Wow.
And all that stuff.
I don't know how that flag could be offensive, honestly. I mean, the only way I find it offensive right now is when it's synonymous with a Trump flag. That's what makes me pissed off, because Trump is just a freaking guy. Okay. I don't care who he is, whatever. Like, you guys can have all your days. He's just a guy. America is bigger than that. Okay.
Yeah.
So much bigger. And yeah. And so it shouldn't be hijacked like that. And I just like, it's offensive to me, you know?
Well, you're saying that the flag is bigger than one individual.
Exactly.
And that's
100%.
And that's absolutely true. I mean, I've always respected the flag. I've, regardless of political differences, and maybe I'm wrong when I say we all rever the flag because of what it represents. It represents the country.
And this is another idea that came up recently. Is America an idea, or is it a place in your mind?
Well, the American dream is what immigration was based off of, coming to America, getting a new start. So to that, I can see it being an idea of success, an idea of prosperity. But it is still very much a place. We still have borders. We still have,
sure.
You know, this is our land, this is your land, you know, and I think that you can have both.
Yeah, that's good, man.
You can have both. You can have that idea.
Good. Good job.
But we need to get that idea reestablished, I think, with the general public. I think we've lost sight of what...
You can have both. I like that. I think that's great. Because I do think... So what I was talking about, Tom, before you came, we had a little about like an hour of talking before, maybe 45 minutes, is I think what the founding fathers were trying to do was figure out what humans need, right? Like, not just us as
just
British
people.
Citizens, but people.
Right.
Like, what do all people, universal needs, like life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, right? It's things you cannot deny. And I think that ideal of America is super powerful. And I think that's why we've been so popular, you know, as a country. And we're new. It's an idea. But it is a place too.
Right.
Right. So it's both. But I think it needs to be revered in both ways. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what it is. You know?
And I think they need to be revered together.
Together.
You know.
But not limited just to the geography of America. I mean, I think that's why people around the world have loved us in some way, and sometimes not now maybe, but like because of that, like freedom.
Oh.
Freedom. Right?
Well,
they love coming here.
That's what the whole Cold War was.
Yeah.
It was the United States trying to preserve a level of a democracy, republic, versus the big red scare and communism.
Yeah, communism. Yeah. So Tom and I have been talking a little bit on the side about how socialism has been, and communism is a type of socialism, right? There's about 12 different types of socialism. And so communism is state-sponsored, you know, no market factors. It's state-sponsored. It completely authoritarianism. Okay, that's
right.
Communism. That's the far left corner of the graph, right? And so, like, we actually are a little bit socialist in the far right upper corner of the graph.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and I don't think that it's a big deal, you know. But what happens is politicians right now and a lot of people and media and all the people that are trying to sway people in certain directions are saying that if you vote for a Democrat, you're going to vote for communism. And it's like... That is so wrong to even say that, because communism is like no Democrat is talking about communism. Okay, some of them are talking about democratic socialism and some of these other things. Socialism, they are throwing out those terms, but they're not talking about communism. And it's really irresponsible for some of these politicians to be saying that a vote for Democrats is a vote for communism. You're going to turn into Venezuela. It's really irresponsible, in my opinion, for them to say that, because it's way a big stretch, you know.
Well, and that's what some of these militia groups believe, though.
I know, and that's the thing. They get fueled by these
people. And
exactly.
There does need to be a very big balance. in my mind, what we need is some, you know, multi-billionaire who is tired of Republicans, tired of Democrats, and wants to have something that's a little bit more moderate, something more in the middle. But all these Libertarian, Green Party, all these things, they don't have enough backing to be a viable party.
True.
We need...
I know. That's why Tom and I are centrists.
That's,
because
know,
really, that's the best place to be.
There needs to be somebody who's going to endorse some politicians. You know, there needs to be a lot... If we want real change, if we want a balance to this... left preventing the right from doing stuff and the right preventing the left from doing stuff, you know, the fight between the House and the Senate, all this stuff, if we don't get real third party players and in there, I don't think it would be nice
if we had a third party, but I have a high, the only third party I see coming up in the near future is the Trump Party.
Yeah, that's true.
That's going to be it. It could be very well be a third party.
You know, one thing I think all Americans should do, you need to read George Washington's farewell address to Congress.
Absolutely.
And you know what he said? And this was very wise. Said, do not create political parties, because political parties will become self-serving and produce nothing. And that's, you know, I just don't understand the rift between the Democrats and the Republicans. You know, have you forgotten about the American people? Have you forgotten about the people out there that by no choice of your own are victims of a pandemic? They need help now. We don't need to be spending money on this, that, and the other. We need to help ourselves. And I hear this stuff about, well, what, we can't afford this. Yes, you can. That money's all going to go back into the economies, and now you've got families who are struggling and who can pay taxes again. You know, I don't know. What do you think, Jake?
You know, my ideas might be a little progressive on some of this stuff, but, you know, I think that unemployment is a good program to have, but why can't unemployment lead to, after X number of weeks of straight-up unemployment, if you need to continue those benefits, then you need to do 20 hours of community service for your parks department.
I agree.
Or you know, doing something in the city.
I think that's a great idea.
Or whatever. To, you know, 20 hours, 4 hours a day, 5 days. That still gives you time to go find a job.
Yeah.
And I
brilliant.
I really think people will go find jobs. They may take underpaying jobs. They may be underemployed, but they're going to take a job versus painting park benches, raking leaves, whatever. And I think it'll motivate them to just not live off of the government, which may in turn, you know, lead to advancement of their livelihood.
Well, no, I agree with that, Jake. I think everybody who can work should work. But what bothers me right now, excuse me, is there are all kinds of families out there who, through no fault of their own, COVID-19 are saying, well, they don't have jobs anymore. And I'll bet you the majority of those people, instead of sitting around and worrying anxiously about where's the next paycheck going to come from, where am I going to pay the rent, would much rather be working and know where that money's coming from.
Right.
That's what kills me. You know, we hear, oh, well, these people just don't want to go back to work. Well, no, I don't think so. I don't think so. The American spirit is to work. And people who have never been in this position before all of a sudden are dependent upon government subsidies.
Which they're getting pennies, though.
Penny, yes, they're, exactly, yes.
Yes. You know,
it's not enough to live on.
No, they're getting pennies. And it's like, this is a shock to them, because these are well-meaning people who had jobs, they were supporting their families, and all of a sudden they can't do it because they're out of work because of this pandemic that nobody wanted. Nobody.
Think about how many industries have been impacted by this.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's just insane. Like,
pretty much every industry.
Yeah, but some more than others, too. Like, some directly. Like, you really, you can't work anymore, you know, and you're just done, you know.
Right.
And maybe you have a family.
What was it? The Tyson plant in what, Iowa?
Oh, yeah, chicken.
Yeah. Like, 95% of the workers all had COVID, and the plant had to shut down.
Yeah.
And supposedly one of the managers of the plant had a pool of how many people were going to get COVID and miss work. And so he was under fire for that. But so it spreads.
I wonder how many chickens were injected with COVID. Well, am I eating? Luckily, I don't eat Tyson chicken.
Or nuclear waste.
Or do you?
I don't buy it from the store because it's like not that good. I don't know. It's like the cheapest frozen chicken that you can buy, Tyson. I don't know. Maybe I get it.
I don't know. It depends what label they put on the packaging.
Yeah, I don't know. Do there I eat chicken? Yes, I eat chicken. I do. But I eat, you know what my favorite chicken dish is? Chicken thighs. I'm going to tell everybody this.
Man.
This recipe real quick. Man. It's going to just give me like 1 minute to tell this recipe.
All right.
Casserole dish. Load up the casserole dish with the chicken thighs. Salt and pepper. A little bit of salt and pepper. A little bit of olive oil. Dash of nutmeg on both sides. 1 hour at 350. You're done.
Yeah?
That's all you got to do.
The nutmeg, huh?
Best thing. Nutmeg is the key.
Nutmeg on chicken?
Hey.
Don't knock it till you try it kind of thing?
No, it's cool. Jay. I've just never heard of nutmeg on chicken before.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's the best thing ever.
Yeah, thighs are the best.
1 hour. 1 hour, 350. You do that. It takes 2 minutes to prepare, and you throw it in for 1 hour, and you hit it, and you're done.
It's amazing. And you're talking bone-in, skin-on, or?
I would typically do boneless.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a little easier with boneless.
Well, it takes less cooking time to do boneless.
Well, you just buy them from the, you know.
But what I love, I mean, this is the Hoosier mecca of republicanism side of me. Although I'm not a Republican.
You sure, Tom?
No. I love to take them, put them in milk.
Oh, boy.
And then flour and fry them. That's the best.
Well, that sounds good, too.
Yeah, it does. That's
Tom does like a lot of fried chicken.
Does I've sound had like it. A lot I've more work. I've
got
to admit,
he's got some of the best fried chicken I've had.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that sounds like a lot of work.
No, it's not really.
It's a labor of love.
Labor, and all that stuff. All you got to do is 2 minutes. In fact, I'm going to make some tonight.
Oh, all right. You know, I am impressed, John.
Got room in there?
What do you got on for socks?
Oh, I got some lobsters on my socks. That's it.
So you went from tapatia to...
You know, my wife is a big sock person. She buys crazy socks. I don't know. I just grab whatever socks are in my drawer and put them on. I don't think about it. So, back to the most important issues of the day. You know, I don't know if we talked about... Did we talk about the COVID relief bill at all?
Not a whole lot.
Just at the very beginning. Did you know that in the COVID... In the omnibus bill, not the COVID relief bill, but in the omnibus, it's a fiscal spending bill, basically. They have a submarine in there that's $2.3 billion. One submarine.
One submarine.
$2.3 billion.
That could deliver nuclear missiles to any point in the world on a whim.
And they have $2 billion for Space Force. So you can move, U.S. National Guard, you could be Coast Guard, you could be Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, or Space Force.
Yes, you can.
Actually, they're called the Guardians, though.
Are they?
That's what they called them, the Guardians.
Wait a minute, who's called the Guardians?
The Space Force is called the Guardians.
Guardians of the Galaxy.
Guardians.
Guardians of the Galaxy.
Mike Pence said that's a funny thing. Guardians, that's their name.
See, in my day, that would have been science fiction.
Well, we're here. You know,
that would have been a whole series.
Tom, you made it. You made it to the future.
So just like the Coast Guard
is
part of the Department of Homeland Defense, the Space Force, even though it is underneath the Air Force, it's separate from the Department of Defense entities like the Coast Guard is.
Yeah, it is. $2 billion. Only $2 billion to Space Force. Whereas $700 billion to defense.
Well, just wait till we start building our spaceships, okay? That'll all change.
Well, money, what is money?
I don't know.
Money
anymore.
Is what we print in the mints, my friend.
We just approved $2.3 trillion.
Okay.
This week.
Well, we need to get the mints to print more.
Like, it's not being printed. It's just like a button you press. It's like 2.3 trillion. Like, let's make it a quadrillion.
Yeah.
Why are we stopping at a trillion?
How often do you carry cash on you anymore? I mean, really?
I always got a little bit of cash.
This is a good point.
I always got a little bit of cash just in case.
I'll bet you right now if I go to my wallet, I don't have anything but plastic in there.
Well, you're such a millennial, Tom.
No, you called me a millennial. I'm a baby boomer, God damn it.
millennial boomer is what you are.
But no, I have acquiesced to the times.
I know.
I mean, people, I put cash out in front of people your age, and they're like, what, whoa, whoa.
I don't want to touch that dirty stuff.
Yeah, I want to touch that shit. Okay, so I use my card because I put it in a machine that tells me to enter my PIN number and all that stuff and blah, blah, blah. Okay, that's fine, but it's still just, it takes the personal interaction part of it.
Well, it just doesn't mean anything anymore.
Well, it's like
money doesn't mean anything anymore.
You guys don't answer your phones. Fluff. I have to text everything.
Yeah.
I mean, it has taken me time to get used to that.
So I'm impressed that you've adapted to that.
That's amazing. Thank you.
My dad has never sent a text or an email in his life. So,
God bless his heart.
I'm not a big texter. I'd rather just talk to someone.
Yeah.
Have a 10 minute conversation versus an hour and a half back and forth texting.
It's not always like that. I think each situation is unique, and some situations do require a call. Some require, some it's just much easier to text. But Jake, I would like, you have a lot of papers on that desk over there. Is there anything else that you want to talk about? Because we're getting a little close here to the end.
Yeah, really.
Is there anything that you had on your mind that you wanted to discuss?
You know, I think one of the biggest things that we talked about that kind of hit me was getting that American spirit, that American ideals back. And I really hate to say it. I think that MAGA actually embraced that, but it went the wrong way.
I agree.
If it wasn't so polarized, it would be
amazing. I think that's why it became such a movement. That's why it became a movement. Just exactly what you said. It's because it embraced it. It's like that was the hope for it.
Right.
But it was sort of the whole onset of it was sort of not real. And it was sort of a weird, I don't know. I get what you're saying. It's like we all want to be. We want our country to do well. We want our people to do well. I mean, and I think that people just grabbed onto that because it is a good marketing.
But instead of uniting us, it divided us further, and that's the frustrating
because
the
essence of it wasn't real. The essence of it. May not have been real. Let's say because Trump in himself is sort of a okay. No, I don't want to go there.
Yeah,
I don't want to go there because like everybody has their own opinions about it. But I personally think that there are some things that like if something's coming from a genuine place, then why would we not agree on it?
Right,
right. And I don't think it came from a genuine place. I think it came from something else. And I can't describe what it is.
Right.
But it didn't come. I don't think it came from a genuine place. I think it came from something else. I'm just going to leave it at that. But okay, what else you got?
So, you know, to kind of with the whole militias and martial law and stuff. One, from everything that I've seen, is there's nothing in U.S. law that authorizes the president or Congress to institute martial law. They do have the authority to call upon the states, National Guard, the United States Army, not the Army, but the National Guard, to assist.
Then what is martial law if it can't be called? Like, what is it? Like, why does it even exist if nobody can enforce it?
Well,
like,
it's not just an American statement.
Oh,
it's an interpretation.
Is it fascist? What is it?
I don't know. I
is it like a fascist thing?
Well, like, I think in times of emergency and people are lost and have no direction. And they see soldiers that are there to, whether it be a show of force or to secure stuff. When I was down at Katrina, I had a rifle. I had a magazine that had 10 rounds in it. I didn't have one in the chamber.
Katrina was crazy, too. Yeah, for sure.
I was an armed soldier. And I patrolled a school, a water tower, and a gas station out in the middle of Mississippi to make sure that nobody was vandalizing or trying to steal gas or whatever, or breaking into the school to try to get the food out of the kitchen or whatever.
Did you encounter anything funny?
Had a guy come up to me while I was at the gas station. We hung out there because, you know, sitting at a school that's in a military vehicle is just kind of weird. So we were over at the gas station quite a bit, and, you know, every hour we'd hop in the Humvee, drive around and you know, check everything out. Never had an issue. But this guy comes up, and he goes, "You know, you're in the moonshine capital of the world." I said, "Oh, really?
I believe that."
And he goes, "I ain't talking about Mississippi. I'm talking about Wayne County, Mississippi."
I believe that for some reason.
I look at this guy, and, you know, he looks like he just came from his still
out
in the middle
teeth
of the woods.
Have?
Not many. And I said, "You know, I'd really like to try some of that world famous moonshine." And he looks at me all cockeyed, and he says, "You can't arrest me, can you?" And I said, "Not unless you're actually like trying to steal gas or steal food out of this store." And he's like, "Well, maybe I can get you some." So he comes back later, about an hour later, and pulls a Mountain Dew bottle out of the trunk of his car.
Always a good sign.
And, yeah, sure enough, he brought me 20 ounces of moonshine, which really kind of pissed me off, because later that day, my buddy who was riding along with a police officer, good old Steve Cohey.
Oh, my God.
He... The police officer says, "Hey, watch this." And he flips around and pulls this guy over, searches his car, pulls him out of the car, handcuffs him. And the guy's like yelling, "Why are you doing this to me, Joe? We're cousins. You know what I got?"
Yeah, it was Cohen.
And the cop is just telling this guy, "Hey, I'm just putting on a show for this Army guy." So long story short in that is Cohen got a full gallon. Oh. And I only got 20 ounces.
So was it good? What was it good?
So
it was Cohey, amazing.
It was amazing?
Yes.
So Cohey gets a gallon, you get 20 ounces?
Yes.
How does that happen?
Are you saying that Wayne County, Mississippi might be the best moonshine capital in the world?
I've had some shine from here and there, but down there it was really good. They've got a real nice artisanal well that they pull their water from
good quality water. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Best.
So,
well,
but yeah. I don't know how we got to there.
I think that that's the one thing that you might take away from this entire conversation is that Wayne County is the number one moonshine place in the world. If that's all you took away, that good for you,
right?
But I think it's been fun. Anybody else have anything else to add? And last chance. And listen, I think we're going to bring Jake back here a couple more times. This is a long-term deal here. So,
I'm not bragging here, but even in lieu of the fact that he's my favorite son-in-law, he's done a great job. And Jake, I would like to hear more from you because you have a great handle on all this stuff about martial law and blah blah blah.
I think he's got a lot of great life experience too.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
perspective. Yeah, I do too. Perspective. Yeah. Yeah.
So I would be more than happy to have you back.
All right, it'd be my pleasure. This was fun.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to say one last plug for our email address, but I don't give it any hope because nobody sends the emails. TheJohnAndTomShow@gmail.com. Send us questions. If you want to call in during our show, you can do that. We will take questions. If you email us, we will tell you when we're going to have our next podcast, and you can call in live while we're doing it, and you can be on the show. Okay, just email us at thejohnandtomshow@gmail.com. All right. Thanks, everybody. Hope you have a good one. By the way, it's December 30th.
Yes, sir.
We only got one more day left in 2020.
Oh, I know.
So we just do one big last FU to 2020.
Yeah. Well, you know what's funny, though? Here, I mean, I hate to be the bearer of black crepe. Whoa. But everybody thinks just because Friday comes along and it's a new year, as far as the COVID-19 pandemic goes, I think we're in for a few more dark times. But the good point is that we have a vaccine, and I think that's going to help a lot.
Yeah, I hope so.
In the months to come. Because
thank you for that, Tom. Thank you. Jake, last words.
I'm good. Thanks. This has been a blast.
Jake is the best, and I appreciate him coming here. Right. I really appreciate you coming here, man. Thanks.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Bye, everybody.